Hi, folks. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And my sobriety date, by the amazing grace of God and the power of this program, is February 2nd, 1957. So, mainly what's in my eyes is bags, right? You had to get up early to come to Nebraska. I hit it at 4 o'clock this morning and lived in great peril thinking I might wake my wife up. And I swear to God, that woman is vicious at high noon, and she's impossible at 4 in the morning. So I stealthily eased out of that bedroom. And if I look bad now, I want you to know I hadn't been drinking any wine. It's just one of those things that's wear and tear on the body. I'm just getting over a little pneumonia thing, and I hope. So if I go into barking fits, you'll know that it's the diagnosis is a little premature there about recovery. But I'm delighted to be here. I was thinking about, you know, when you get old, everything reminds you of something. And this meeting today reminded me of a lot of stuff. One thing in particular, I was at a conference, a workshop similar to this in North Carolina 3 or 4 years ago, and we had a little break in the planned agenda, and the chair led an open session, you know, with questions and comments and whatever. And right off the bat, there was one fella stood up, and you know how you just sort of get instant kinds of impressions and you just snap to judgment. This guy looked like a very, very unsuccessful drug dealer. He was greasy hair, and I swear to God, he just looked like death warmed over. And I thought, oh, Jesus, now what? Because I figured it was going to be, why don't you love drug addicts or something. Well, it doesn't pay to snap to judgment. Because what the fellow shared was, well, I guess one reason I valued it, it made my ears turn just a little red. And because he hit right at home. He said, one thing that's always puzzled me is when we talk about trying to get people into service, we try to recruit them by telling how aggravated, how frustrated, how angry, and how disappointed we are and how used up we are. And he said, somehow that just doesn't sound like a program of attraction. And boy, did I ever feel the heat. Because how many times I have tongue-lashed somebody trying to drive them into the joys of service. Tell you what, he could have come to Lincoln, Nebraska today and seen everything he ever wished for realized. What a fine, civil, intelligent, reasonable treatment of the issues of service. Good, good work. I haven't heard one angry thing, even talking about the difficulties of working with corrections people. I haven't heard any anger from either side. By the way, I want to commend you also because most of the time, the reciprocity between corrections and an AA is imbalanced at best. Normally, if you can get a corrections person out on Saturday, it's because his boss said, get over there. And when you can get one to come on Saturday and stay for the entire deal, that's historic. Yeah. Man, we're going to make a plaque to you, Darren. I would introduce him. His name is Darren, and he works at the community. You guys know where that is. Community Correction Center. I could almost tell you his phone number because he told it. But if you, you know, what a fine representation of not only professionalism but engagement in the process. And that's just excellent. I was really delighted to be here. And I do want to compliment you on an excellent turnout. I didn't get any of the chili, but it smelled good. Yeah, y'all look like you liked it a lot. I would have some, but there ain't none. So, now what I'm supposed to do is talk a whole lot about drinking and puking and all that wonderful stuff that you want to hear about after ODing on chili. But I'm going to tell my story, but I'm going to do it in a way because of who we are and what we're here tonight. I want to bear down on things relevant to correction. Now, I'm not a correctionaholic. I'm an alcoholic. But a good deal of my experience, in fact, most of the last 42 years of my life, I doubt that there have been many days in the last 42 years of my life that haven't hovered around issues of corrections, either in it, working in it, thinking about it, planning about it, what have you. So it's been very much a part of my life for a long, long time. And so I want to share tonight, because of who we are and because of the peculiar mission, if you will, that pulls us together. So I want to dwell on that a little bit. No, I want to dwell on it a whole lot. I really would like to talk a lot about drinking, too, because I love to talk about drinking, especially mine. I think it's wonderful. I can relive those thrilling days of yesteryears ad nauseum. I love that stuff. But I'm not going to do it. Let me start where I rarely do. I found myself, I started to say came to my senses, but that was a little slower process. I found myself as a 24-year-old guy sitting in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thought in those early days that my life was bad enough already and it had suddenly gotten worse. So here I am in the Legion of the Damned, sitting with a group of people whose sole purpose, all they talked about, was drinking and, more importantly, not drinking. And they talked about it in disgusting terms, like not drinking forever. And I was not somebody who fell in love with the mission of Alcoholics Anonymous right off the bat. You can hurry and believe. You know, I couldn't imagine going a week without drinking on purpose. And here, I'm a 24-year-old guy. If the insurance companies are right, I'll live 50 years, and that's a long time without a drink. And so my first period in Alcoholics Anonymous was basically a tug of war in my own head, where when I'd sit in there and listen to somebody tell their story, and I'd hear the joy that comes and the happiness that comes, and I'd find myself thinking, God, do you suppose a guy like me could get this? And then the other disturbing thought that would crowd in was, my God, what if it works? What if it works? And I'm going to get struck bone dry. Better than average chance of becoming pure. Absolute guarantee that I'll never smile again. And, yeah, I'm 24 years old. My life should have just been starting. And instead, I'm sitting in a group wondering if you could get another shot at it. And I didn't even feel like I ever had the first one. And so the prospects of me were dim at best just on that. The other factor that made it extremely difficult was that first meeting was in a maximum custody penitentiary. And I was sitting there serving 15 years for a crime that I didn't even remember committing then, now, or ever, but a crime that I knew full well I did commit, in which I took the lives of two people. So I'm sitting, a 24-year-old guy, in a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous in a maximum custody penitentiary, contemplating a future that looks non-existent, looking at hopelessness, despair, such a feeling of absolute self-loathing and disgust that all I wanted to do was disappear. And I'm sitting in Alcoholics, excuse me, I told you about the bargain. And I'm sitting in a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous where people are talking about hope and help and stuff like that. And it was so far removed from me that it was an unthinkable gap between where I was and where it sounded like other people were. And so that first period of sobriety for me was not only thinking in terms of the impossible task of not drinking for a long, long time, it was also filled with an enormous amount of even having the will to live, much less desire, the will to live, with looking at a life that, honest to God, it's not melodrama, it's a fact. Looking at a life that, in all honesty, then, now, and ever, would have been better had it not happened. It would have been better for everybody involved if it hadn't happened. And so I'm sitting in that joint thinking, what happened? What went wrong? Surely to God, this wasn't what I had in mind. And who would? And so a good deal of my time was spent in trying to figure out what went wrong to cause an average guy to wind up in such a god-awful circumstance. And certainly it was not any real quick revelation about what went wrong, but slowly, as I listened to other alcoholics tell their stories, mine started to emerge. At first, I thought alcoholism was about getting drunk. And if that's what it was, I'd had that all my life, because I got drunk the first time I ever drank in my life. The last time I drank in my life, I got drunk or wanted to. I couldn't remember a single time when I drank with a sense of sufficiency. I've never had the feeling. I've marveled to this day when somebody turns down a drink. I don't understand why on earth anybody who could drink doesn't. But they don't. My God, I watch them on airplanes. They give free booze. And I take it and take it home to my wife. I ain't turning down no free booze, whether I drink or not. There's something weird about people who could drink and don't. I mean, when I listened to those stories and started to say, that's what I thought, was that alcoholics at first sounded like alcoholics are people who got drunk and got in trouble. Well, that was certainly me. And when I acknowledged alcoholism, admitted alcoholism, it was like a guilty plea. It wasn't an admission of an illness. It was like a plea of, yeah, I did it. But that wasn't quite it, though. And I listened, and what I started to hear went a little deeper, a little deeper. And what I started to hear is that alcoholics were people who were miserable if they didn't drink. Who drank in a squirrel cage fashion, they drank because they drank. And boy, did that ever start to make sense to me, where I could see that this was a vicious cycle where it was a self-feeding, self-destructive kind of behavior. I started to listen to people describe the peculiar state of mind that precedes a drink, like Doc writes about in the Doc's opinion. That peculiar state of mind that precedes a drink. God, could I ever relate to that? How many times I've gone through that feeling of going for some little, not long, but some period of not drinking, and then having that uneasy feeling about nothing. But can't sit down, can't stand up, don't want to talk to anybody, look out the window, pace back and forth. Some call it restlessness, irritability, and discontent. Peculiar state of mind. And I started to hear that. And God, how many times? So gradually, I started to recognize that, you know, I was just like every other alcoholic in the world, and finally got to a point where that had real meaning. And so when I look back at my life over a period of time, just a few months, what I saw, you know, I had always been a miserable, out-of-sorts guy. I was self-centered, isolated, distant from people, very secretive because of a lot of things that went on in my life. I was somebody who would never let anybody get close to me. And I think heart and soul of alcoholism lies in a thing called self-centered isolation. What it led to with me was a whole range of defects of character that I won't go into tonight, but those deep-seated things that became the obsessions of my life were what started to slowly emerge. Suffice it to say that I was a guy totally lost in himself, totally locked into self-centered isolation. Then I found booze. And when I found booze, It was easy for me to see why I drank. That stuff did magic for me. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. Loved the places, the people, the action, the smells, the noise. Loved everything about it. And I just took off. I was a man, a boy, really, freed. I was freed from the prison of my life. And man, I'm telling you, I was as free as a bird. I not only was able to join the crowd, I led the sucker most of the time. I was just that kind of guy. There's just a whole bunch of stuff with that. And that's what happened. Booze worked for me. It was not a problem. It was a big-time, major-league solution. And I really would have been stupid not to drink. Man, I never had anything work as well for me as booze. And I tell you something, it never quit. It never quit. The only problem is that the solution became the problem. Because I developed alcoholism. And if that weren't the case, you'd have a different speaker tonight. I don't care how ugly that looked, it felt good. It felt good. And that's what I would be doing tonight had I been able to drink even in the reckless, crazy fashion that I drank. That's what I would be doing tonight. I'm not here on moral grounds. I'm not a temperance worker. I'm not against booze. In fact, I'm all for booze. I encourage people to drink. I like to see people drink. That's where we get our members, you know. So I ain't against it. I'm dangerous to serve drinks. Because I always figure I'm doing my little recruiting piece. Well, yeah, that's what I'd be doing, except for one thing. I developed alcoholism. I understand a little bit about it, but I'm not going to go into it tonight. Suffice it to say that was not to be the case for me because it was in the cards for me to develop alcoholism. Now, I don't know why. Whether it's genetic, heredity, too much, too long, who cares? Really doesn't matter. What does matter is that I understand without one iota of doubt that I, when that time came and I crossed the line, as we call it, I separated from every other drinker in the world except other alcoholics. I am not like other drinkers. I never will be. And the issue for me is that I simply can't drink. It's not an option. You know, alcoholic insanity is an option. Drinking is not. Because I'm somebody, if I drink, I cannot predict my behavior. And that's what my life became. And so when I look back at that life trying to figure out what happened, God, could I ever see it? You know, here was a guy that I was wild and crazy before I became alcoholic. I went to jail before I became alcoholic. I wasn't a criminal particularly. I was just a guy that got in the way all the time. I was just messing stuff up. Hard to run a place of business with carpet on the floor and organ music and some guy throwing up on your carpet. That's mostly what I did. I wasn't a predatory gangster or anything like that. I had my moments, you know. Some, I don't know much that a man can do that I haven't done. But mine was mostly among my own kind. You know, as my life progressed, if you could call it that, I wound up living in some God-awful circumstances. And I used to survive the way you survive on the street. The last year that I drank, I drank on the street up in the city of Flint, Michigan. You know, a rapid deal happened, and in that setting, I survived like you survived. I truly don't know of much that a man can do that I haven't done. Now, you can hurry and believe, that's no Wild West story. That's no macho drunk story. I'm deeply ashamed of that. But I pray to my God that I'm never ashamed enough that I'm unwilling to share it. Or even worse, that I forget it. I never want to forget for one second what the issues of alcoholism were for this guy. And I survived in that deal. One night I'd roll somebody, the next night they'd roll me. It just depended on who was the fittest at the moment. And that was just the way it worked. I mean, there was no apologies for that. That was just the way it worked, the way of life. And I never want to forget that. Never want to forget that demeaning, demoralizing, lonely, anxious, angry, frustrated, dirty, disgusting kind of life. I never want to forget that for one second. Because I'll assure you that that's what drives me today. It's not the fear of going to jail, losing job, losing wife, none of that. It's the fear of losing that shred of humanity where I would have to go back to being that empty shell of a person. That's what drives me. And I never want to know that again. Well, you know, what brought me, I told you in the beginning of you, when I looked at that, I could see that, you know, I was like a runaway train. I was just crashing through life. And it was just a matter of time until I would crash and burn. You know, either I had to be locked up on a regular basis. I don't even know how many times I've been in jail. Don't have any real interest in it. I never have felt any need to research that. It's a relative term. You know, what difference does it make? The thing that's important to me is recognize I'm the kind of guy who had to be stopped very often. I like to think that I've been in jail the exact right number of times. Maybe one less wouldn't have been enough. And maybe one more would have been too many. That number is the right number so far, and I'll settle for that right now. So when I look back, that's what I saw, was a life that was just riddled with that kind of stuff. I honest to God, could not recall then, now, or ever, one single person that I had ever known in my life that didn't get hurt or dirty or embarrassed in the process. Not one. And so that's what I looked at. And so it was just inevitable that I would wind up. I always figured I'd just wind up somebody shooting me or just ODing or whatever. And I really, those were conscious, clear thoughts even in my drunkest days. I knew that a guy like me would not have a long career. You just couldn't do it. Nobody's going to drink long who drank like me. I guarantee you that. There won't be a 30-year drinking career. And so, you know, it'd be nice, you know, if it had happened differently, but as you gathered, it didn't. I woke up one morning in jail up in Flint where I was living. No novelty there. I took it for granted I was in there for the same as always, drunk, hustling, fighting, whatever. And a jailer came by, guy I knew. I asked him when I could get out, and he said, "I hope never," and walked off. And I really didn't know what he was talking about. Had not a clue what he was talking about. And then some of the other guys in there, the tank there, told me that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city and had run down and killed two people. And even though I was a street character, a really goofy acting guy, yeah, I was not a subhuman. And my response to that was, I guess, a very predictable one. That I could believe it, but I couldn't accept it, if you know what I mean. Could not deal with that. Didn't gradually accept the truth. And then later on that year, I got out on bond after 76 days, knew I wouldn't drink, knew I wouldn't. I didn't think I could physically pick up a drink. The guilt was too great. I just didn't understand what alcoholism's about. Stayed sober a day and a half, and of course I drank. From July to November of 56, literally like nobody I've ever seen. And then had what I hope and pray was my last drink, the 19th of November of 56. That morning, I finished a bottle of gin, about like that, went to court, you know, and I knew that mine was to be a one-way trip. I took everything I owned, which wasn't much, and went down and knew I wouldn't be back. And I'd never heard of the plea. I'd never entered it before, but the fellow that was my attorney told me to stand mute. And I thought, what an eloquent plea. What an eloquent plea. What can you say when you don't even know? They had to tell me what I'd done. And, of course, I was found guilty and sentenced to that 15 years. And I remember the day that happened as clear as if it were today, that I had, a very normal, instinctive reaction of fear, but almost simultaneously the most real sense of relief I'd ever known in my entire life. I knew it was over. It was over. And the next day I walked in, they took me in there on a chain with five other guys into Jackson Prison. Now, I knew Jackson Prison was not Disneyland. I'd hustled around with some guys that were in and out of that joint, and I knew that it was a bad news place. I've been in penitentiaries all over this country, and I don't think anybody rates those things on a scale. They all suck. I've never been to a good one. But if I had to rate Jackson, I would rate it the second or third worst penitentiary in this country. And I think it's worse now that I go back every couple of years just to make sure I ain't there. And maybe to say a little something to the guys that are. But if the day I walked in there were 6,000 guys locked up in that place. And I took my place among them. And I truly never believed I would ever get out of there alive. Truly didn't care. And that was not cynical, callous disregard. It was just over. And I really did just want to disappear. And then somebody, you know, interesting thing about staff. Sometimes you think staff have trouble penetrating. Very interesting to me. Well, it's more than that. It's interesting now. It would have been vital at the time. I responded to the first mention I ever heard of a solution to alcoholism. I had never heard of anybody helping a drunk in my life. They didn't do it back then. Not in my circles. I didn't know anything about it. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a social worker at that prison, a guy named Martin, real rookie, had just come out of Michigan State. I don't think he knew anything that wasn't in the textbook. But he didn't need to know much. You know, he looked at my record, knew I knew quite a bit. And so he looked at that, exclaimed what many others had, you've got a lot of trouble with booze. And then he did something nobody ever had. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution, think you better go. It was just an observation. It was not an order. I didn't have to do it. It certainly wasn't an invitation. It was just a flat observation. We have a group, think you better go. And I walked into my first meeting. Yeah, it has something, though. The first time I had ever heard those words, and I've never had a drink since. I suspect that there were at least 100 points in my life where I would have responded similarly. Bottom's not a one-time thing. And God, how many times I would come to that point of desperation. Think of nothing except the solution I knew, or suicide, or what have you. Well, it's just speculation. But the point is that alcoholics don't have to be hit with two before. Sometimes they just need somebody to say, hey, guy, over here. Sometimes it works. Well, I walked into my first meeting. Groundhog Day. I don't think anybody planned it that way. And I walked into my first meeting in the recovery group at Jackson Prison. I started at 8:30. No, I didn't. I started at 7:05. He'll tell me when I get. I walked in, just like but most people in this group are well aware with what you're dealing with a guy walking into his first meeting. I walked in the recovery group at Jackson Prison, a huge group. It had 300 members in that thing when I went in, and most of the time while I was there. And one guy spoke to me. He had an officer on the door. I checked in. I asked him, yes, sir, sit down. I sat down in the middle of that 300. Thank God nobody hugged me. I was not interested in that. One of those hairy-legged dudes who tried to hug me, I think we'd have had a tussle going on. So I didn't get any of that. But I sat down in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody told me what to expect. I wouldn't have believed it anyway. And then they did exactly what we did tonight. Almost entirely. They did a couple other little things. But read the same stuff. Hadn't changed a lick. I mean, we ain't improved it one lick in 40 years. Same stuff. And then the chairman introduced the speaker. And he introduced a guy by the name of George Walker. Now, he'd hurt you if you called him George. He was the delegate, Mark, Ken. He was the delegate from the state of Michigan. They only had one back then. On panel 9, you said, Charlie. Yeah. He was a delegate. And he was my first speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, delegate didn't mean a thing to me. Shaw Walker didn't mean a thing to me. You know, in terms of any clear identification who he was. But that man stood up, told his story. And I swear to God, I'd heard a lot of alcoholics tell a lot of stories, but not their own. And this guy had to be telling the truth. Nobody gonna make up junk like that. And I sat there in just shock and amazement. I thought, what on earth would a nice-looking guy like that get up there in front of 300 convicts and tell some god-awful story like that? And I honestly didn't know. And I was a long ways from the brother's keeper ethic, you know, where it helped me. That had not existed in my world for a long time. And he was a fairly nice-looking fellow if you didn't get too close. You know, if you got close, he did not bear close examination. Guy was an ex-everything. He had done everything in the world. This guy had been a very unsuccessful criminal. Very, very, very persistent, but very unsuccessful. The last sentence he did was for robbing a Superior Court judge. Now, come on, man, you got to be nuts. You don't rob a judge. He got 47 cents from the judge. That's my hero. And he's telling this stuff. This guy had done time in an institution. He'd been out 15 years, as long as I had to go. And he told stories that I kept looking around. Somebody put handcuffs on him. He was telling stories that one of the jobs he had that, I don't know if you got one here, y'all kind of modern, but they used to have in the old prisons rotundas, kind of like the Capitol, you know, with a big old round thing where everybody marched around. And he ran the elevator that the warden rode to his office. Now, that keen alcoholic mind set up a scheme for him, and he built a homebrew stand on top of the warden's elevator. And it never got busted the whole time he was in there, because the fumes would go right out the shaft. And he said every time the warden went to work, he stirred it for him. And I kept looking. They're going to come get him. Man, this guy's crazy. I'm listening to him. Now, I didn't identify with anything he said. Yeah, he and I were totally different people. And if anybody had asked me about that afterward, if I'd have said anything at all, I'd have said, man, you wouldn't believe it. They got a fruitcake in there. I did not identify with anything about that. And the amazing thing is that I went back to the next meeting. I stayed in there 3.5 years, and then they told me they'd turn me loose if I'd go to North Carolina. And so I said, let me think about it. Never missed a meeting. You can hurry up and believe it. It's kind of like I was kidding around a little bit about it there in the beginning, but that's not kidding at all, because that's exactly who I was sitting in that group. And I know without any question whatsoever that the only thing that brought me back to the second meeting and to many meetings thereafter was not the experience of that guy or some vision of hope or some deep-seated desire to change. The only thing that brought me back was that magnetic spirit of enthusiasm that was there. You were talking about that today. That magnetic, contagious spirit of enthusiasm. And when that guy would tell his story, he always did it with such a marvelous level of dynamic enthusiasm that you just valued a minute with that guy. He was a crude guy. He was an uneducated guy, a roughneck. He'd been a professional boxer at one time and apparently fought a little too long and too poorly. He was a real beat-up dude. But what a marvelous man he was. And I know that without any question, that the only thing that brought me back for a good while was that. And I want to tell you a little bit about what clicked. You know, what is it clicked? You know, what is it that made the difference with this guy? Because you can picture who I was. You know, a 24-year-old social wrecking ball. That's all. And I mean, I'm living on nothing but a history that never should have happened and living under an absolute mountain of guilt. And felt deeply ashamed to even be here. Never mind breathing. Never mind trying to find something new. And when I think about that, it simply, profoundly underlines the power of what we're in here. It takes something truly, truly powerful to cut through it in a life like that. And I want to tell you what happened to me, and I'll just kind of hit highlights of what I think happened when I look back and say, well, where did the recovery go? What went right? What was it happen? And I don't know why, but for some reason, I developed a sort of I don't know if I had a commitment or a lack of resistance, but it was the same result. I never missed a meeting the entire time I was there. has an awful lot to do with success, I think, is being where the solution is. You know, 'cause you don't get curb service. And so just being there was a start. The first 8 months in this program, I would honestly describe as miserable as any period I ever endured in my life. I was not somebody who got giddy happy right off the bat. You know, I mentioned, I won't go into this detail either, but I mentioned self-centered isolation as something that preceded my drinking. Drinking relieved it. Well, not drinking brought it back in spades. And I was as self-centered, as isolated, as fearful inside Alcoholics Anonymous as I'd ever been anywhere in my life, felt as much out of place as I'd ever felt anywhere in my life. And so I kept going back. I didn't have any sense of fellowship. I said I was an alcoholic because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that was something else. And so I'd say, yeah, me too. But it didn't mean a thing. It was just a word. It had absolutely no meaning to me. Thank God for that group. The recovery group back then was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I mean just that. It's kind of like you saying, Ken. Yeah, you were talking about that group then, and I'm sorry to say it, but it was superior in terms of effectiveness to 90% of the groups that I visit in this country today. And that's a fact. I wish it weren't so, but it's a fact. And thank God for it. Thank God that it was a well-ordered group, purposeful group, did an excellent job of taking new members and helping them to understand the design for living that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was taught this by the guys in the joint, not rocket scientists or not missionaries from outside. Surely they helped. But guys in the joint, just like me, the only difference was they were a little bit in front of me. Thank God for those guys. Some of the finest meetings I've ever been to in my life were not meetings at all. They were times when a few of us guys would gather up under a tree on the yard, share like men seldom do. Some of the most powerful meetings I've ever been. And boy, how those things have served me. Fundamental, no-nonsense, good, solid grounding in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for that. Thank God for the folks who came in there from the outside. The people who walked in to my life, and not on a personal level, but collectively, I was one of the bunch, people who walked into my life and gave me what they had, themselves. People who accepted me at the level, not like I was, but at the level of what I could become. I was treated with respect, dignity, second to none, by real people. And that was an absolute lifeline. God, how much that meant. A lot of those fellows are dead now. Shai's dead, and a lot of my real heroes are dead. Some still live. I tell you, just a couple of real... You talk about those mountaintop experiences. A couple of years ago, I had a chance to go up to Ann Arbor, Michigan, to speak at the anniversary of AA in that town. And also of a little guy by the name of Jimmy Fondren, he's 95 years old now, and he was also celebrating 51 years of sobriety. He was the originator in that town. Well, what a powerful thing to be able to go back. I was able to give him a 51-year medallion. One of the guys who carried the message to me. Last year, I was up in Montreal with a guy by the name of Mel. Some of you might have read some of his writings. He's a marvelous guy. Great writer. He spoke at my fifth meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the first person I ever heard describe how I felt with words. First person. We were great friends. And we did a workshop up in Montreal together. You talk about the gap between the folks, to be able to go out and share alongside the guys that carried the message to me. Powerful, powerful stuff. Well, those guys were truly, truly, were and continue to be powerful influences in my life. Yeah, I learned early on, you know, when I started to catch it a bit, I went to Shai one day. Shai became my first sponsor. And I went to him one day, and I tried to thank him in my own crude way, I tried to thank him for what he did for me. And true to form, he stopped me before I even got started. He said, wait a minute. He said, we don't do that here. He said, and I've never forgotten this, a few times I wished I could, but he said, you will never be able to repay any sincere member of Alcoholics Anonymous for what they do for you. It doesn't work that way. He said, if you appreciate it, all you do is pass it on to the next guy. Powerful legacy. And how important that was in sort of giving me that desire to live, that notion that I could actually have community with decent people. That, I guess, is what that meant. I was pushed into action in that group. I honest to God, didn't know there was an option. I really didn't. Nobody ever asked me if I wanted to or not. You know, that bunch did stuff. I got in with the bunch, and we did stuff. And I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous there. I have had some of the finest AA experiences I've ever had in my life in a maximum custody penitentiary. There is absolutely no difference one iota in the program of recovery that can be worked there as opposed to anywhere else. This program worked as powerfully for me there as it ever has anywhere. Why not? My God, it's the toughest living I've ever done. If it hadn't, I'd have never survived. I would have never survived. Instead, I walked out of that place 42 months later without a mark on my body or my mind, but with a soul that was greatly enriched. And I'll tell you what, I'll do it in a rushing hurry, but I'll tell you what, it's more than just a warm, rich, fraternal organization. It's more than just loving fellowship with others. You know, there is a design for living that will free people, and I don't care what your captivity is. I shared AA one day with a guy who was in an iron lung. I don't even know if they make those things anymore. A crude old machine that used to make, it would breathe for people. And this guy couldn't move anything but his eyelids. Seemed very few people freer than that guy. You know, this doesn't have to do with your position. It has to do with your disposition. And boy, did it ever work for me in there. And I'll tell you what turned the key. Now, I've always been a reader. All of my life, even drunk, I tried to read. But not very well. It's hard to read with one eye. And I was reasonably aware of the words of the program. The guys had told me a lot about it. But there's an awfully big difference between knowing the words and living the program. You know, and so I was a miserable guy. I'm sitting there I wouldn't have bet a nickel on me. And one day I went to a meeting, and a guy spent the entire meeting talking about nothing but the fourth step. Now, I don't like to aggrandize anything in the program, but this is just the way it happened. For me, fourth step was a very solidifying point. And so I went in there that day, and this guy told about the fourth step. Went into great detail about the value of writing, read part of it out of the book, gave illustrations. And when he finished, I went back to my cell and I said, okay, I'm going to try that. Now, I'd been doing a little thinking, of course, about how such a nice guy as me got in such a mess. It really was doing. What I meant to do was to write a little explanatory article about what went wrong. You know, and you can bet it'd be somebody else's fault. But I was going to write this woeful tale of things that might have been, I guess. The founders were wise when they said to write the inventory. Because I started to write what I had in mind, and I wrote about two lines of that silliness. And then with no intent whatsoever, none. All at once, it was as if I hit a wall. It was what old Hemingway talked about, the moment of truth, the moment when a person comes face to face with themselves. And that's exactly what happened. Didn't plan that. Had absolutely no script, no intent whatsoever. All at once, it was over. The charade was done. And without any thought, preparation, or anything else, it just burst out. It was like a dam broke. And all I did was just pour out my heart. That's all. for the first time in my entire life. Ever. And my hand flew trying to keep up with the things I'd never looked at, much less put out. And when I got through, I had three of those old long yellow legal pad pages filled with scribble. It was barely legible. Sure wasn't fit to print. Wasn't written to print. I tell you what it was, without question, it was the most important day's work this old boy has ever done, bar none. Bar none. Most important. Because that day, I knew without any question what I indicated earlier, I knew I was alcoholic. And I started to experience a critical thing called surrender. Surrender. Where I accepted the cellular level, the reality of my existence. That I'm beat. I simply can't drink. It's not a matter that I've thought it over and elected to do something different. Doesn't even enter the equation. I'm somebody who is beat. It's over. Thank God for that. Because 41 years later, I can tell you that I have never seriously doubted for one second the reality of my alcoholism. Not one time. I've come close to drinking a few times, but because I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, I'm not a reformed somebody. I'm an alcoholic. But never once have I come close to drinking with that old delusional junk of, well, maybe you overreacted and quit a little too early. None of that. Maybe you're not really an alcoholic, you know, considering what that last guy wrote. No. I have never, not one second, had any question whatsoever. Very, very important. I tell you this, and it's just the only editorial offer tonight, how critical that is. I have never seen any long-term success in recovery unless surrender is there. It just doesn't seem to happen. It doesn't happen because it's a nice thing to do and it's wonderful here and everybody's patting me on the back. No. It has to be something deeper than that. And that's my belief. And so that's what happened to me. And the other thing, that day, I became a solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was no longer the face in the crowd. I was no longer the different guy. I was no longer the youngster in the group. I was no longer the tragic case. None of that. I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never wavered in that. You know, how important it was to have resolution for a change. Meetings have never been the same for me since. Never gone to one and not known exactly why I was there, including this one. Very important. And so I went to work in the program, and the hardest work was giving up. The good news is that it truly worked for me. It truly worked for me. Enough so that I became a free man. A free man. In every sense of the word, except physical. I was freer than I had ever been in my life inside a maximum custody penitentiary, locked up like a monkey in a zoo. And I became a free man. What a wonderful, wonderful transformation. And got caught up in the stuff of Alcoholics Anonymous. Helped start new groups. Started one in the TB ward. The darndest looking meeting I ever went to. Guys with masks on. Looked like we're getting ready to rob somebody. And that's back in the old days when the TB wasn't controlled like it's supposed to be now. Started one in the mental ward. And it was great fun. Interesting meetings. I mean, we sometimes had 10 going on at the same time. But you know, what was happening is that I was learning to function as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, a couple of marvelous things happened to me just in the course of that. It's amazing what happens to alcoholics in recovery. Now, there are notable exceptions to this, but most alcoholics don't need anybody to say giddy up to them. Now, there are some that you've got to blast them with dynamite to get them to giddy up. But most of us have enough compulsive drive that we wind up wanting to get three jobs instead of one. You know, catch up, all this junk. Well, I got started doing stuff. And I swear, I didn't even know it, I don't think. Somebody invented television while I was drunk. I woke up and there it was, old Howdy Doody in there just blasting away. I mean, he wasn't blasting in there. But Michigan State University decided, I don't know why, they decided to extend their campus to Jackson Prison on television. And I couldn't believe it. I was able to enroll at Michigan State University. It didn't let me go to class up there, but all I had to do was buy books, pay tuition, and I became a card-toting, beanie-wearing freshman. It's a strange thing. You really get some profound stuff. I'm not a great sleeper. I never have been a great sleeper. Drunk I did very well, but sober I've never been able to develop the art. And the first 3 years, and that's hard to admit this in a maximum custody joint, you're supposed to be macho. I didn't admit it. It's kind of hard to even admit it retroactively. But I couldn't sleep in a dark room. I wasn't afraid of the dark, but my system was so shot, my nerves were just firing in all directions. And then I get in a dark room, it was like a kaleidoscope. Man, everything in there is going off. And I couldn't sleep for 3 years. I mean, I slept, but I mean, not much, and not in a dark room. Man, I had to have some light somewhere. Well, I heard in a meeting one time, if you can't sleep, stay awake. Now, is that heavy or what? Is that heavy? But God, did it ever make sense? Because that's what I'm doing anyway. And I finished 2 years at Michigan State University because I couldn't sleep. And most of my work was done at 3 and 4 in the morning. Amazing what happens in this thing. I was recommended for special parole. Didn't make it, but I was recommended. I didn't realize it, but in the state of Michigan, that happens once in 10,000 cases. I didn't even know it existed, and they picked some yo-yo like me. They wouldn't put me in minimum custody because my record was so bad that they knew I'd be gone like Hogan's goat. And they were probably right. But they recommended me for special parole, turned it down, and then later on they told me I could go. And I swear, I never thought I'd tell this, but it just shows what happens when you get caught up in living, that your situation really doesn't matter that much. The night I was packing to leave, I found myself thinking, geez, I just wish I had one more day. Now, I didn't tell anybody that, because I didn't want one more second. But I had so much to do that I just wished that I had, very secretly wished that I could just wait a little bit longer and get some stuff done. But I figured maybe somebody else might rise to the occasion. I hope they did, because I left them. And then when I hit the street, it was, let me just tell you one other thing about this transition business. Yeah. And I know that, you know, it's not just in CFC. I heard you guys talking about that we don't have as many people doing CFC work, but you talk to Mark, Ken, any area of service, you know, you'll find a strange kind of truism in Alcoholics Anonymous. The closer you get to the work, the thinner the crowd. And when you start trying to do service work, I don't care what kind of service work it is, you're going to find fairly lean crowds. Now, I can tell you that it has not gotten better in the last 40 years. I can tell you that for an absolute fact. There are places in this country that if you mention who Larry is, the new CPC chair for the area, if you mention CPC in some areas of the section, they won't even know what you're talking about. They'll think it's a new detergent or something. And that's sad but true. And so we are more challenged, not less, by where we are today in terms of the vigor and intensity and focus of our service work. And I don't want to be like the greasy-haired guy and start fussing about it. It's just sad, because that's where the joy is for a guy like me. It's where the joy is. But what I was getting at, when I was getting ready to get out of there, I personally believe that the most critical time in the entire experience of corrections is that period immediately following release. Immediately following release. Because, you know, when a guy's coming out of there and he's going to change, I'll guarantee you he's going to be the loneliest cat in town when he hits the street. Because every instinct's going to be to go back to some place where he felt okay, rather than just a lost face in the crowd. Now, I was fortunate in that when I went into Jackson, it so happened I had the longest sentence of a group of guys that had come in, and the fellow was doing a vocational orientation thing, what he was doing. And he was talking about, he singled me out. He said, that's who I had time, and it turned out I was the longest guy. And he said, now you think you got a long time. I said, yeah. And he said, let me give you one suggestion. The time to start planning to get out is today. Not wait till you're right at the gate. Boy, was that ever profound. And I believed it. You know, I had a job lined up through my family 3.5 years before I was eligible for anything. Lousy job, but it sure beat cutting hair in that penitentiary for 10 cents a day. So I had a job lined up. I saw guys actually cause themselves to serve more time than the judge did by simply not making arrangements. I saw other guys leave with what looked like optimism and hope and then greet them back in short order. And I'll guarantee you, now I'm a kind of a cold-blooded dude, I learn more from losers than I do winners. And when I get one of those guys back, I couldn't wait to cut his hair. I was a barber. And I couldn't wait to cut his hair. Because usually when you get a razor at a guy's throat, he'll come close to the truth. And so I'd get him and I'd say, tell me what happened. And they'd give me the litany. So critical thing. I believe that a year before I was to get out, I wrote a letter. But I didn't write it. A staff member wrote it for me, the first letter. He wrote a letter to, we had an A director there that had two groups listed in my hometown. So we wrote to the biggest group. It naturally would be the best. So we wrote that letter in sometime, almost 40 years ago. And I know the mail's slow, but it ain't that slow because I'm still waiting on an answer. And, of course, you know what the answer was that I filled in the blank with. And we wrote the letter and nothing came down. I said, okay, sure. Now, these guys like Shy and the other guys that come in here, of course, they're good guys. But they got a bunch of stuffed shirts out there. Don't want anything to do. And all I was asking in my letter was, is it okay if I come? That's all. Didn't even ask for a friend. I just wanted somebody to say it's okay. Well, thank God I wrote a year in advance because my bubble just burst. And so I talked to some people who knew about it. These folks told me that, you know, unfortunately, everything that causes itself an AA group isn't. I mean, there are some things that may have been at one time, but they quit being Bible groups. Unfortunately, they keep meeting. And they spread the disease rather than the solution. And maybe you wrote to one like that. Or sometimes they die. You know, they just go away. Well, I didn't think about that. I thought, they hate me, you know. Don't even know me, but they hate me. And so I finally sucked it up and wrote again. This time I got a letter back quicker than the mail could have delivered. But it did. And the guy answered in spirit the same way I wrote. Just basically said, man, we want you to come here. Imagine saying to a guy in a Max Cousins joint, not only will you be welcome, we certainly accept people like you here. They told me about their activities. They told me about institutional work they did. They told me about their gatherings. A simple letter. Put one line in there that was worth $1 million to me. Said, you'll be welcome here. We want you and we need you. God knows. A powerful message, eh? Powerful message. When you're wondering if anybody would ever want you anywhere, really. Powerful message. That's what I worry about, you know, with the evaporating service ethic, you know, where it's so hard to get response to this kind of thing. Never realize how desperately somebody's life might hang in the balance. And that's what
concerns me about, well, a lot of stuff. But anyway, yeah, I hit the street, got immediately active in my the group that became my home group there. Thank God I was pretty well prepared when I left, because that was a shaky group. The guy who wrote me the letter and became my second sponsor when Shai died moved away. And I all at once became the second oldest man in the group. And the oldest one had border... we hadn't invented Alzheimer's then, but he had it. And we just thought he was a little different, you know. But I tell you what, it's good to be prepared, because I had the remarkable experience of going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in that town alone. That'll make you check your deodorant, I'll tell you. It's a weird feeling. You think, am I the only cat going? You know, thank God for good preparation. Thank God for hanging on. When I left that town, you know, it's not particularly credit to me, but some credit. When I left that town, we had 60 active members in that same group. And so, you know, somebody has to plant the flag. Somebody has to keep the faith. Somebody has to make it go. And if you get a good, strong foundation, folks will come. And so I hit the ground like that. That group did visit a prison over just a few miles from my home, and they told me I could go with them. And I couldn't believe that. 2 weeks after I was out, you talk about a year or 5 years. Now, this was a simpler day, and I understand that. But 2 weeks after I was out, I was over there visiting a place like I just left. Yeah, and I couldn't believe that. Now, 2 months after I was out, just a few weeks after I was out, I made my first real AA talk there. I didn't know it, didn't plan it. The chairman night went over there, two of them sitting on either side, one on either side. The inmate chairman said, "Who's speaking?" And each one got me by an elbow and said, "He is." And that was my first real AA talk. I haven't quit since. I just kept going. 2 months after I was out, I was asked to be outside sponsor of that. I guess you call it coordinator or something, but the outside sponsor is what we call that. And it was my job to be the service representative for that group. What a tremendous affirmation for a guy who just left the joint to be a responsible servant to a facility like that. Tremendous thing. I want to tell you just very quickly about some things that happened, because I know, and Mickey, you know some guys that are awfully lacking in hope. Sorry you got to leave, guys. Now leave the money before you go. Don't leave with the money. Okay, take care. I want to tell you about just a few things that happened, and particularly because I know that you know not every story is a happy ending, you know, and some stories are sad endings, and most do fairly well. But I'm here to tell you that I'm one guy who can testify to the fact that there's hope. That there's hope. I don't care who you are, what your situation is, I'm here to tell you there's hope. And I just want to tell you some stuff that happened. You know, I'm one who believes, I'm a very practical man. I'm a spiritual man, but I'm a very practical guy. I believe in the way it says in the book, it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but have those flat feet on the ground. You know, and so I approach life that way. I believe that life is made up of a lot of what we call miracles. And I don't like to take the wonder out of miracles, but I like to make them very, very meaningful in terms of the spiritual life as a way of life. And when I practice the spiritual life as a way of life, my God, it's amazing what happens. Because I think miracles are essentially what happens when preparation and opportunity come together. You remember what I was talking about, surrender. If there is no surrender, there is no recovery. If you get the cart before the horse, it just doesn't happen. Preparation and opportunity. A farmer plows the field and he plants the corn in Nebraska. And God causes corn to grow. That's the miracle of preparation and opportunity. And the same thing with me. And when I started out in this program, all I did, you gathered what I did. I was just a broken, beat up guy sitting on a life that never should have happened. And essentially what I did through the process of surrender was to give myself to this simple program. It wasn't a decision. It was just just the way it happened. I gave myself to this program. And my God, what happened? It gave me freedom in a maximum custody joint. Gave me recommendation for special parole. Gave me release. Gave me access to work with guys at joint. Let me be outside sponsor. 2 months after I was out, pro supervisor came to me one day, and he said, "Tom, you're real active in this A thing." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he worried me because I thought he was going to ask me to slow down, and I knew I wouldn't. And he said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't," as if he wasn't aware of that. And he said, "Well, let me take a look at that." A couple weeks later, he called and asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown. And this story is true, absolute detail. It's absolutely true. I went up to the Sears, my daughter's sister drove me up to the Sears store, and I could see my man all the way at the back of the store talking to a guy I didn't know, turned out to be the license agent. I walked up to them, introduced me to the man, we chatted a bit. And the guy, when he got through chatting, handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. Had a car. No test. Verbal, written, nothing. Didn't even pay for it. Now, you know that's illegal, man. That's, but I've been driving ever since. Yeah. What I believe, that's what I call a miracle in preparation opportunity. I wasn't looking for that. I believe if I had been trying to manipulate the state of North Carolina to do that, I'd be walking today. I truly believe that. Instead, I gave my life to the simple program, and I believe with all my heart, not only on my case, but God knows how many others, when God worked for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what they are. They come down. And 5 months after I was out, I was elected DCM. You talked about getting elected. Larry was talking about getting elected DCM, wasn't even running. No, Kurt. Kurt was talking about getting elected DCM. I couldn't even spell DCM. They didn't teach that at Michigan State. And I was elected, and I'll tell you what, it meant a great deal to me. Here were the folks in 12 cities. Same guy who wondered if he would ever have one friend or be trusted by anybody. And I was asked to be the trusted servant for my closest folk on earth. To be their trusted servant, and it meant a lot. 2 years after I was out, sitting in my house one day, got a call from the state capitol. The guy introduced himself. I'd met him one time. He visited the AA group that I sponsored in that unit, and never had seen him since. And he called me. He said, "Mr. Ivester," said, "we are expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." Now, I mean, you got to picture this. That's not totally unheard of today. In 1960, that was totally unheard of. There'd never been an ex-con in history hired in anything like that, and I knew they weren't going to start with me. And so I said to him what I truly believed. Up here I said, "God knows, man, I'd rather do that than anything." It had never occurred to me, nor anybody else. And I said, "Yeah, I'd rather do that deep down." You know what I said. "There ain't no way. There ain't no way." And sure enough, in 61, I went to work in the North Carolina prison system in North Carolina, the Department of Correction, we call it now, as a rehab supervisor, and had a marvelous time. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I'll assure you, doing time does not teach you how to administer a prison. It does not. You sometimes think you know how, but it's a little different. And so I went to work, and it worked my fanny off. And I stayed in school. You know, I finished up my education in correctional administration. I mean, they didn't just recruit me out of a maximum custody cell to take over the world. But I bothered to outwork anybody I've ever met. And one day, after I'd been there for a while, several years, I really got to count it up, 8 years, something like nine, whatever. I was going on, minding my own business, and the head of our system asked me to come by his office. I went by, and he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take an assignment for me." And I said, "Yes, sir, what?" And normally he wanted me to speak at a civic club or something, you know, to pinch hit for him. That's normally what he wanted. And I said, "What?" He said, "I would like for you to take over an institution as warden." That will never quit sounding ludicrous to me. I mean, with my history, as somebody say, of all the stuff that a guy dreams about in a joint, I guarantee you that never makes the list. You know that? Yeah, I'm gonna get out of here and run one of these suckers, but sure about it. It's just so foreign. And when I got up off the floor, I said, "Hey, boss, I don't know if I want to do that or not. I didn't want to beat a man. I wanted to mud wrestle with the guys. That's what I like. And then it dawned on me that perhaps with a little authority, I might be able to do some things. And I knew I would give up some of my you know what I'm talking about, some of my primary feedback where I was working right to the guys and get a chance to press to flesh and feel to feel. And when you become the man, you sacrifice some of that. But then I said, well, okay, and I did it. And took over my first institution in 68, and then from then on, it's more than an interesting thing to me. From the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous until today, I have never applied for a single job, promotion, transfer, pay raise, nothing. And I've gone from that literally to the top of my profession. Preparation and opportunity. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what the walls are. And so that's what my career became for the next 20 years or so. I basically was a guy who, I've always been a guy that I always challenge things. And so my deal in North Carolina was to develop new facilities. And so I was able to open some trendsetter institutions that stand to this day. And a legacy that means a great deal to me. And I'm still in corrections. I'm still working full time, but I've got sort of a nothing job now. I work state level, and I'm the guy that goes out with the briefcase and says, I'm from the Capitol and I'm here to help you. And they all say, oh yeah, sure. And we're glad to see you. Well, anyway, I'm more excited about what I'm doing right now than I've ever been in my life. Now, I dwell on that just a little bit because of I hope you see the symbolic value of this. I had a young fellow getting out of the institution one time that I kind of liked the boy. He was a nice guy. He was doing well in the program. He came by to say goodbye, and I said, well, I appreciate that. I said, visit a minute. Tell me what you're going to do. And he started to lay out his plans. And I've heard lots of plans from lots of guys, and most of them, frankly, are pipe dreams. And he laid his out. He said, well, when I get out here, I'm going to finish over here at the two-year degree I'm working on right now. Then I'm going named to college where I'm going to get my undergraduate degree. Then I'm going to work for one summer. Then I'm going back and get to law school, and I'm going to get my law degree. And I said, George, are you sure you can do that? He said, I've already checked it out. I can do that. And I say, well, buddy, I'll tell you what, I wish you Godspeed, and if I can ever be of help to you, you call me. Well, a few years later, the guy called me. He said, hey, boss, you remember what you told me? He said, I'm having my ethics exam. They have to go to a board where they talk about their suitability, not their smartness, but their character, ethics kind of base for being an attorney. And he said, I need you. And I swear, I was really at a jam in the institution, but I said, nah, shoot, I'm going. I don't care if we have to close the place and send them all home. I'm going. So I went down and met with that board, said what I had to say about him. Then I said to the board something of what I think I'm saying about myself. I said, guys, let me tell you that I not only endorse this man, but I want you to approve it. Because of the symbolic value it will have for every man and woman in prison in this country. Tremendous thing when a guy can set some aspiration and then realize those aspirations. He's practicing law today in North Carolina. Pretty good lawyer, I think. He's going bald, so I know he's worrying. And he's got that look of concern that a lawyer ought to have. Some folks say that comes from hemorrhoids. Anyway, it's just, God, what a blessed man I am to not only, what's happened in my own life, but, there's a place in the book, and I'm going to quit. There's a place in our book where it describes what this process is about, where if I give myself to this simple program and let it take me where it will, a lot of things it says, well, I'll be amazed for them halfway through. And that one of the things that will happen is that I will be able to find a life, develop a life that's usefully whole. Usefully whole. Boy, oh boy. Is that ever true? Is that ever true? Not only usefully whole, but eminently rewarding. You know, I'm probably the busiest man I have ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's about my tempo. I was the busiest drunk I ever met. And so I think it has to match up, you know. And so I'm a busy guy, and I do a lot of stuff. But I'll tell you this, I am the most richly rewarded guy that I know. Boy, am I ever. And the thing that's so important to me, it's like anybody else. I've got a family. I've got a couple of kids that finished at the university system. I've got a wife that has mixed feelings when I do this too many times for too many weeks. But nonetheless, we've got 30 years of continuous marriage. We've got a life that has prospered. And there is nothing, absolutely nothing, in the Ivester household that isn't richly blessed. See, what I did was give my broken and wasted life to this simple program. And what it gave me back was an adventure beyond imagination. One of my great fears when I came in here was, what on earth would I do with my time? You know what a joke that is. It's the God's truth. I cannot remember the last time that I was bored. I can't even remember it. We will be fired with brand new spirit. And what you guys are doing right here is at the heart and soul of this. I don't know of a finer area of service. Now, I'm personally biased. You know that. But God, does this ever light me up? Thanks a million. Thank you, God.